It's time to get down to business with $30 a month business internet. WOW Business offers 99.9% network reliability so that you can keep your business moving. $30 a month gets you 30 megabytes per second with 24/7 US-based support, a price lock guarantee, and a 60-day satisfaction guarantee. Lock in our lowest priced offer for the support you need. Go to switchtowellbusiness.com. Offer for new customers with a 2-year agreement subject to change. Prices do not include taxes, fees, and equipment charges. Restrictions apply.
You're listening to the Master Wildlife Filmmaking Podcast, Episode 6. This episode, I'm talking with IMAX producer Chris Palmer. Chris is a professor, speaker, author, and environmental wildlife film producer who has swum with dolphins and whales, come face to face with sharks and Kodiak bears, camped with wolf packs, and waded hip deep through the Everglades swamps. Chris serves on the American University's full-time faculty as Distinguished Film Producer in Residence. In 2004, he founded AU's Center for Environmental Filmmaking at the School of Communication, which seeks to inspire a new generation of filmmakers and media experts to create informative, ethically sound, and entertaining work that makes a difference. Chris also serves as president of the McGillivray Freeman Films Educational Foundation, which produces and funds IMAX films on conservation issues. McGillivray Freeman Films is the world's largest and most successful producer of IMAX films. Over the past 30 years, Chris has spearheaded the production of more than 300 hours of original programming for primetime television and the IMAX industry. His films have been broadcast on numerous channels, including Animal Planet, the Disney Channel, PBS, and TBS. His IMAX films include Whales, Wolves, Dolphins, Bears, Coral Reef Adventure, and the Grand Canyon Adventure. In the course of his career, he has worked with the likes of Robert Redford, Paul Newman, Jane Fonda, and Ted Turner. His work has won him and his colleagues many awards, including 2 Emmys and an Oscar nomination. And from his treasure trove of experience came his 2 controversial and entertaining memoirs about the dark side of wildlife filmmaking, Confessions of a Wildlife Filmmaker and Shooting in the Wild, links to which can be found on masterwildlifefilmmaking.com under the resources section of this episode's webpage. Chris, thanks so much for taking your time out this afternoon to speak with me on the Master Wildlife Filmmaking Podcast. How are you this afternoon?
I'm doing great. And Jake, I'm so happy to be with you. Thanks for the honor of having me on.
Oh, absolutely. It's a pleasure. Now, Chris, first of all, for our listeners, can you just give me a kind of short introduction to how you got into wildlife filmmaking? Because I know yours wasn't a typical kind of entry into the industry. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes. And until I was about mid-30s, I knew nothing about film or video or television. All I knew was how to turn on the NBC News at night. That's all I knew. Up to my 30s, I was an environmental activist. I would start in my career designing warships and, you know, worked on Capitol Hill, worked for a U.S. Senator, Jimmy Carter, and so on. So I had a variety of different jobs. In my early 30s, I started thinking about, I was working for the National Audubon Society, and as an environmental lobbyist, I began to think, how can I be more influential? How can I do more, achieve more in my work, in my job to protect the environment? And it occurred, the obvious thought occurred to me, well, if I were to help elect the congressmen and senators in the first place who are better oriented towards the environment, to protect the environment, that would be an advantage. That would be, you know, instead of me lobbying, they would already be persuaded to do the right thing, to protect climate change and all the other things. So I developed some ideas and formed a partnership with the cable mogul Ted Turner. And it's a long story, which I write about in one of my books, Shooting in the Wild. But the bottom line is that he gave me millions of dollars to make films. And we made about 60 or 70 of them over about a 10-year period, all of them with celebrities in them and all focused on different environmental issues. So, Jake, that's how I got into television.
And then from then, I mean, that's incredible. That's a huge amount of output in terms of making shows over that period of time. And then you went on, I know you had a big career with making IMAX movies. And go ahead. Tell us a little bit about the IMAX movies.
Well, once I got into television with Ted Turner, we got our shows on public television and TBS Superstation. Then I began, in a very entrepreneurial way, doing other things. I started getting into video games, started getting into PSAs, started getting into educational outreach, started getting into IMAX films, started getting into movies. We did things in all these areas and others, computer games. In terms of IMAX, I got very interested in it and raised for my first IMAX film was on whales, and we raised $3.2 million for a film on whales, and it did very well. It grossed, it's still making money, it's grossed about $60-70 million. And that led me into a career, along with lots of other things I was doing at the same time, in producing IMAX film. I now work with the legendary IMAX filmmaker, Greg McGilvary at McGilvary Freeman Films. I'm the president of the McGilvary Freeman Films Educational Foundation, and our latest IMAX film is National Parks Adventure with Robert Redford. Greg directed it, and his son Sean produced it, and it's doing very well. It's the highest grossing IMAX film this year in the world, it's all about promoting the national parks.
Oh, wow. And I've not had a chance to see that one yet, but I've seen many of your others over the years. I mean, IMAX films tend to be that very blue chip, giving a sense of grandeur. I mean, it's an incredible format to work in, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. So, Jake, and you're right about that, because they're evergreens, because they go on for years. So you won't find them in them anything about legislation that you want to get passed or ish, they're more general. I like them to the tip of a spear. They allow lots of things in their wake where we can tell people specific things to do. The films themselves are about 40 minutes long, and they tend to be very enveloping big screen. That's right. Not specific to any particular legislative issue. Yeah.
Yeah. Now I know from reading your books, Shooting in the Wild, and also Confessions of a Wildlife Filmmaker, which came out, I believe, last year.
Right.
Great books, and they're really insightful because they deal very much with the ethics in wildlife filmmaking. And I find these fascinating because I think it's a big move for someone like yourself to come out and say, there were times throughout your career where you felt you were ethically not doing the right thing by making a certain movie in the way it was made. And I think it's fascinating to see it from an insider's point of view. And they're very, very good books, well worth reading. And I know a turning point came for you in the IMAX film Wolves, in Confessions of a Wildlife Filmmaker. You speak about how you had a showing of the film, and afterwards you opened up the floor to audience questions, and a young boy, I believe, asked you a question about how you managed to film a mother and her cub, a wolf mother and cub, in her den. And I'll let you complete that and say what happened.
Yeah. Well, what happened was I got a visceral shock to my body, because this young person said to me, well, as you just said, how did you get that shot? And to give background here, Jake, when we made the film, we didn't think much about it. We just did whatever we needed to do to get the shot, because that's what filmmakers do. You do whatever you do to get the shot. And we often very rarely think about ethics. If you would need to, you need to rent an animal, or you need to set something up, or you need to stage something. Filmmakers, for the most part, just think of that as filmmaking and go ahead and do it. What this young, this question, this young person made me think was, oh my gosh! I mean, he said to me, oh, how'd you get that shot? And so I had to make a split second decision: do I answer the question and give away the fact that we staged it, or do I, as many filmmakers do, hide what went on? And treat them like trade secrets, like a magician treats their tricks, and not say anything about it. And I think a lot of filmmakers would go that route. In fact, I've seen that happen many times. People have asked how you got a shot, and the filmmaker will say, well, that's a trade secret. I can't really talk about that. But in this case, I decided in that split second, I said to myself, look, I'm just going to tell the truth. And I said, well, we actually rented those wolves. We made the den. We dug it out ourselves. We made the den an artificial den. And that's how we got the shot. And when I said this, Jake, I could feel the disappointment, the visceral disappointment in the room. And it really spoke to me. I thought, oh, my gosh. So I said to myself, gosh, we have done something that once the audience knows we've done it, they are disappointed. And that struck me as something was wrong with that. You know, if the audience doesn't, if they knew the truth and wouldn't like it, then I thought we were doing something wrong. There was something wrong with what was happening. And so that was one of the things that led me to think hard about the ethics of wildlife filmmaking.
And you actually say in there that it's not like you didn't say in the credits that they were captive animals that were used for filming. It was actually quoted in the credits that they were captive animals and where they came from.
Well, in a way, what we did was in the credits, we simply thanked the game farm from which we rented the animals. So, but we didn't announce in big letters those animals were rented. We simply, amongst all the credits, and in an IMAX film, as you may recall, Jake, all the credits go by us very quickly, and there's a vast number of names on one screen. The screen is vast, and so you put a lot of names on it, and so hardly anybody's going to pick that up where it says in small print, you know, thanks to the wild animals on Montana for the wolves. I mean, no one's going to see it. So, we could claim we didn't hide anything in the credits, but we really did because we knew no one was going to see that.
Right. So this opens up a huge scale of ethics that you go through in your books. And just to, I kind of want to tackle these one at a time because it's a big gamut. I mean, we're running from a few examples, filming ethically shot footage, but then adding Foley sound to it after, all the way to using things like captive insects within kind of little, man-made theaters, manipulating wildlife. Things like, I know you talk about using whale calls to call whales in, placing skulls and other things on the bottom of the ocean to tell a story, right through to things like handling wildlife, manipulating wildlife and altering behavior, which, in the more recent years, we've seen a lot of that with this kind of cheaper reality-led television.
Right.
I'm very much guilty of this as well throughout my career. I had a situation a few years ago filming in South Africa with baboons, and there was a baboon that I got very close to because it had been rehabilitated by humans, put back into the wild. It was on its own, living a solitary life now. And we were kind of told, you can get as close as you like. It's habituated to humans. And I did. And it actually went to kind of bite me. It gave me a warning and shooed me away. And that woke me up to, the ethical practice of getting too close to animals. So just working from the bottom of the scale up, if you like, you talk about your IMAX film Bears, bringing it home and showing it to your wife. And your wife being amazed and saying, wow, that scene of the bear catching or playing with the water, trying to catch fish, and you can hear the droplets of water dropping off the paws and the splashing in the water. How did you do that? And when you gave the explanation, your wife was pretty upset with that. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
Yes, so I brought the film home and showed it to Gail, my wife, and you told the story very well. She looked at it and said, "That's a fantastic scene. I love that picture of the scene of the bear climbing down the mountain, stepping through the water, and then as you just said, she said to me, "Well, but wait a minute, how did you?" I explained that we were across a valley with a powerful lens, telescopic lens, and that's how we got the shot. And so then she thought a minute. She said, "Well, wait a minute. Then how'd you get the sound of the water dripping off the paws and off the paws of the bears?" And I said to her, "Actually, you know, I've got a very clever sound guy. He put water in a basin, splashed it around with his hand and elbow, recorded the sounds of the splashing and dropping of the water droplets, and then cleverly matched it to the footage." And Gail looked at me. Now remember, Gail knows nothing about film. She's not a filmmaker. She's a health policy advocate. She knows nothing about this. And all she knows is that I'm producing scientifically based documentaries. And she looked at me and said, "You mean you cheated? I can't believe that you cheated," she said to me. She couldn't believe that we had done this. And that was another wake-up call for me because, again, most filmmakers wouldn't think twice about this. I mean, what's the big deal? We're just putting in sound. And they've got a point. I mean, both sides have a point. Gail has a good point because once she realizes the sound wasn't real, she said, "Well, what am I listening to?" I mean, you know, she felt cheated. But filmmakers also have a fair point when they're saying, "Well, what's the? I mean, that is filmmaking. Filmmaking is cheating. Filmmaking is doing things you need to create an experience when people watch it on the screen." Both sides have some validity to them. But I think the bottom line, Jake, is that filmmakers, wildlife filmmakers, need to be more sensitive to people like Gail who feel outraged when they suddenly realize that what they're listening to is not real. They watch the film on whales or bears or wolves, whatever it is. They watch these types of films assuming they are authentic, real, truthful, and accurate. And when they find out that it isn't, it undermines the whole belief in these. That undermines their faith in these types of films. And that is a dangerous thing for us, we filmmakers, when our audiences suddenly begin to question what we do and the validity, authenticity of what we do. That is something we have to be very wary of.
Well, it's kind of a double-edged sword because, you know, I think when you're talking about putting audio over, you know, there's two ways you could have filmed that. You know, you're ethically staying back the other side of the valley, filming the bears so that you're not interfering with their behavior. And so you're viewing natural behavior of a bear doing its thing. Now, you're not going to be able to film sound at that kind of range. So adding it in after, you know, that's the lower end of the spectrum. But then, of course, the far end of the spectrum is this manipulating wildlife, like you said, you know, perhaps using captive animals, building a den, or even handling wildlife. I know there's an incredible, you know, piece of footage of, and you talk about this in your book, Brady Barr with a reticulated python, pulling the snake out of a crevice in a cave, and ends up getting bitten by it while submerged in kind of guano water inside this cave. And in Brady's own words, it's a train wreck, and it really is. I mean, watching that footage, it's a train wreck. Right. He's screaming. Right. It's super unprofessional. It's dramatic TV that I would have hoped if I was him that at the end of the show they would have chosen not to put that footage in. But they did, and it is, it's a train wreck, right? But, of course, that is what builds audiences in this day
and
age.
Well, that's right. He went on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno bragged about it, talked about it. Right. So they were it's a train wreck, but they were very proud of it, you know.
So where is the line that we can draw in the sand? Because at the end of the day, you've got these two very far away ethical issues. Foley sound all the way to the other end of the spectrum. How do we draw a line in the sand and say you don't go over this line for any issue? Or do we have to take each issue individually and draw a line for that issue?
Well, I think actually the answer is a little bit of both, because but let me answer it this way. You had those two poles, Jake, you just talked about, the Foley sound, which is low level ethical violation, though a lot of people wouldn't even say it was an ethical violation, towards the other end, the Python story you told. Those are two extremes. But let me frame my answer in this way. There are three ethical problems in wildlife filmmaking. One is where the audience is deceived. Two is where the animals are abused. And three is where the conservation message is not clear, and is not even mentioned. And those three issues are, there's some gray in them, actually. It's not all black and white, because let's take first one, audience deception, which would include the Foley sound story that you talked about, or any time when the audience is deceived. You could argue, I think reasonably persuasively, that the audience is deceived from the very beginning of every film, because the way you put the film, the way you do the editing, all this is a form of deception, right? in a way. But the way I look at it is that if the film is also doing good, teaching people about the natural world in an accurate way, encouraging them to think in a more conservation-minded way, if good things are happening, if people are getting educated, then I think some deception is acceptable. I mean, adding Foley sound, no one's really getting it. So really, I come out on the opposite side from Gail. I mean, even though Gail was outraged that she'd been deceived, I mean, I myself consider that not a significant ethical an issue, and I would do that again. Now, there may be some kinds of deception which are not acceptable, and some of these actually cross, these three areas I talked about, they sort of actually cross over, they overlap. For example, if you want to get a picture of a snake coming down a tree, perhaps falling out of it, and you want to put the camera underneath on the ground and have the snake come towards it, the way to do that is take the snake up a toad, carry it up, and drop it. So there's an element of cruelty there, and obviously deception, because the audience thinks that the snake fell naturally. So there you have deception and animal abuse mixed together. Now, so going back to this idea of things not being black and white, on the abuse side, on the animal abuse issue, it's actually much clearer, because often, most of us don't want animals abused, and certainly our audiences don't, and therefore it's an easier call to make. But even then, there's some areas which are sort of grayish, because if a film is going to do a lot of good conservation, and it involves an animal experience a little agitation, a little aggravation, a little harassment, but not much, maybe one could say, and I think I would, that, okay, look, I'm prepared for an animal to be slightly bothered, interfered with for a bit, as long as it's not hurt but just aggravated a bit. That's okay if the film's going to do a lot of good. And we see this problem all the time with getting people getting too close to animals in order to film them, and then getting too close, the animals get disturbed and upset. So again, it's all, this is why I said early on to your question, Jake, it's the answer is both, because in some ways you have to look at the particularities of the particular situation. How close are they getting? Are they really bothering the animal? Is the animal really upset? Then it's not good. If it's just mildly disturbed, maybe it's okay. So So, that's a long-winded answer to your question.
No. I think that answers it very well. I mean, I think there is there's an ethical line of which, you know, to tell a good, impactful conservation story, there has to be some manipulation to a degree to be able to tell a full story. And I think anyone who's ever made a wildlife film knows that they're very hard to make. I mean, if you're a filmmaker and you're working with actors, and you know, films are hard enough to make when you can manipulate your actors to tell a story. But when you're working with, and the good old saying of children and animals, you know, it's very hard to manipulate. And so you've got to try and tell your story. And if the message is there, that's the important thing. I think there's a big divide between those films and shows that have a good, clear message that are made for impact, and the entertainment side of things, which we're seeing a lot of these days, which are made purely for entertainment, and more kind of shock value. And hopefully we're going to see a move away from those, which I think is already starting to happen. And along those lines, really, have you started to see, I mean, I know your first book, Shooting in the Wild, your first book in this series, if you like, came out in 2010, when I first met you, actually, at the Wildlife Film Festival. Have you seen a change in ethics in wildlife filmmaking since you kind of came out with that? And I don't mean just because of your book. I just mean in general. Are things moving towards a more ethical standpoint with making these movies?
I think the answer, Jake, is that there are movements. I mean, paradoxically, there are movements both ways. In other words, the pressure for high ratings is so intense that you still have this, the network still experiences this tremendous pressure to produce things which are high dramatic and exciting in order to get ratings. If they don't get high ratings, they're not going to be kept on, and they're going to lose their jobs. You know, so ratings are everything. On the other hand, you've got now Rich Ross and others heading up Discovery, and they have come to realize that films which involve anacondas eating a person, things like this, which are just ridiculous, are not consistent with the brand they want for Discovery. And so they themselves, to some extent, are saying, "Wait a minute, this has gone too far. We're not going to produce Shark Week in an irresponsible way. We're not going to produce films about where they pretended there was a huge shark.
The shark.
In the sea.
Yeah, Megalodon, I think.
Megalodon, and." And so to answer your question, it's not an easy thing to answer, because at any one time there's tons of different programming coming out. But I would say this, that on the one hand, there's still the pressure. Those of us who are concerned with this have to be very much on our toes and combat that type of irresponsible programming, because it's still out there. On the other hand, I think these networks themselves are beginning to realize that they stand to benefit if they produce films which are ethical and responsible. And so there's pressure, I think, both ways.
And it you know, it's one of those things, and I think we've all been in this situation where when you're making a show, documentary, typically you're always answering to a network. If you're making it for a network, they're looking for a certain style of show, and you're out trying to make that. And I guess, you know, this is a difficult question. There's two questions here. One is, you know, who is the onus on? Is it on the network to be ethical in their idea of what you're going out to shoot? Or is it on the filmmaker actually out in the field to be ethical in the way they're filming it? And also, what kind of advice would you have if you for new filmmakers when they get into a career with filmmaking, and suddenly they find themselves with a crew of 5 or 10 or 15, and suddenly they're asked to do something as part of a crew that they find unethical? But really, it could be a, you know, it's a career move for them, because I know from experience that if you're with a large crew and things don't go quite the way you think they should go, you know, TV is one of those cutthroat industries. A lot of people know each other. And if you don't do something you're asked to do, you could be out on your ear and find it hard to get another job. You know, what advice have you got for that kind of situation?
Such a good question, Jake. So let me start with the first part of your question. The onus is on both the networks and the filmmakers, but particularly on the networks. And this is the point, one of the points I make in my book, Confessions of a Wildlife Filmmaker. Networks have the ultimate responsibility. They are ultimately responsible for what goes on the air. So they have to be have to show leadership here in saying what's acceptable and what isn't acceptable. And I would point out and commend the BBC, for example, under Tim Martin, for the work they've done to educate their staff about ethics and wildlife filming. They've done a very good job, and I'd like to see Nat Geo and Discovery copy, emulate them, do a similar thing. But having said that, wildlife filmmakers are often on their own out in the field, and they must also be responsible too. Now, let me come to the second part of your question, because that's such a good one. I mean, if you're a young person, you've just joined, you're just starting your career, you want to do well, you're eager to, you're ambitious to do, be successful, and you're on a small team of a production unit and a small filmmaking unit, and you're asked to do something that, you know, to tie up a wolf or to do something which you think, well, wait a minute, I don't like this. I'm not comfortable doing it. What do you do? Well, what do you do, I think, is because you can't stay up, you can't stand up and sound self-righteous and say, look, we can't do this, you know, because you will lose your job and that's the end of it. And then you'll lose your influence too, because you won't be there to do, you know. So what you do is you just say, you raise the questions gently to your boss, to the whoever leading you, or if you're the boss, to the network, and say, hey, look, I'm not completely comfortable with this, and then speak to their self-interest. If people learn about this, you know, this is going to hurt the network. If we were to do this and the word gets out, it's going to hurt the network. So I think speak to their self-interest. The networks don't want to be lambasted, lacerated, criticized in the press for doing things which aren't good. So it's very embarrassing when this happens to networks. And so I think my advice to a young person would be to don't remain silent, but speak up in a gentle, polite way, just expressing your concerns without alienating other people, and see if you can win people over to your viewpoint. Suggest a different way of doing it, or suggest if it involves causing pain to animals, maybe doing it in a different way which doesn't involve so much pain. So that's about all I can say on that, Jake.
Yeah, certainly. I think that's great advice. I mean, there's certainly conversations that are worth having and should be had in that kind of situation. And on that similar theme, giving advice in general to newcomers kind of starting out, aside from the ethical issues, what advice, if there was one piece of advice, one nugget that you could pass on to people looking to break into the industry, and in a very changed world, I mean, now there are so many things we can do online, there's so many distribution platforms, there's not just network TV. What advice would you give to someone who's just thinking about picking up a camera and starting to shoot?
Well, I'm going to pass over the obvious advice, which is to work hard, to learn technical skills, to learn how to use a camera effectively and powerfully. I mean, I'm going to assume now that someone does all that so that they can actually provide a service to a film unit. They can actually, you know, they have skills in editing or writing or cinematography, whatever. So let's just assume that's all taken care of. The next bit of advice, Jake, I would say to people is work on yourself. Work on yourself to be the kind of person that other people want to work with. That, in other words, that you are honest, you are straightforward, you are a collaborator, you know how to work with people, you listen well, you give good constructive feedback, and so you're the kind of person, and you're cheerful and optimistic, and you work hard, you sharp on time. You know, there's all these what you could label under the broad word of professionalism. You know, behaving professionally. So I think if you shape yourself into the kind of person that other people want to work with, you are going to be able to find work more, because people will seek you out. They will say, gosh, that Fred Smith over there, he's so pleasant to work with. He gets the job done. He's efficient. He's always come up with new, innovative ideas. People want to work with you. So that's the best advice I can give to, obviously, you want to be able to know how to tell a good story, and all those other things, but the things that people forget, I think more than other things, is just being the kind of person that other people want to work with, because then they will seek you out and want you to join their teams, and this is the way to have a thriving career.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic advice. I certainly, throughout my career, have seen people keep their job based on their personality more on their skill set, more than on their skill set, purely because when you're in remote areas working as a crew, you need to get on. And when people work effectively together, you end up with a good end project or product. Last question for you, Chris, because I know you're busy and you need to get on there. Last question for you. What's the most incredible experience you've had throughout your filming career?
I think it's going on location and just seeing the world. I mean, going to Alaska and seeing Denali, and going to the South Pacific, to Tahiti, swimming with spinner dolphins, going to Hawaii and swimming with humpback whales. I mean, I think those types of experience are very sort of memorable. They are exciting. They make the job interesting. I had the pleasure of taking my children with me when I did those sorts of trips, and so I think those are some of my best memories of being in the business. And the other thing, Jake, I think, is many of the people I've met in the business and work with over the years, they've been wonderful people. You know, Howard Hall, Hardy Jones. There's so many people who are just really terrific human beings, and just an honor to be around, to work with, and to have as colleagues. So I've been very lucky there as well.
Well, that's fantastic, Chris. And I want to thank you for your time today. I also want to thank you for all the work over the years, because your films are amazing and an inspiration. And your books, Shooting in the Wild and Confessions of a Wildlife Filmmaker, of both of which I'll put links to on the masterwildlifefilmmaking.com website page, so people can get to them. Both those books are fantastic. They really are insightful in terms of seeing your accounts of what has happened throughout your career, and I think really voicing the whole ethical issue within the wildlife filmmaking industry. So thank you again, and it was a real pleasure speaking with you today.
Jake, thank you. I was delighted to have this conversation, and good luck with this master series. I'm delighted to be on it, and thanks so much for having me on, Jake. I really appreciate it. Take good care.
And you, my pleasure. If you've enjoyed this episode of the Master Wildlife Filmmaking Podcast, then please leave a rating and a comment. And remember to subscribe to keep up to date with the series. You can find out more information on wildlife filmmaking at masterwildlifefilmmaking.com, where you'll find valuable free resources like downloadable reports and video tutorials. Thanks for listening.
If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pair.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.